Hello and welcome to Moas. What's life like for a Rohingya refugee in Bangladesh, and how do they survive? They're just some of the questions the Exchange Foundation has been asking in their latest snapshot survey. Using the Shamlapur and Unchaprang camps as a starting point, the team's been able to explore the daily lives and challenges the refugee community face. We caught up with Exchange just as they were analysing the findings of over 1,500 surveys. Here's Maria Jones and Yanis Papasilikas.
Exchange was on the ground during the most recent Rohingya exodus following August 25th. We were trying to understand the reasons behind the movement in more detail. For this survey, we wanted to see what the daily lives of the Rohingya in the two camps, in Unchaprang and Shamlapur, were like 6 months on, with a view to researching certain areas further or advocating on their behalf to plug gaps in the system. So we really wanted just, as the name suggests, a snapshot into the daily lives of populations in two camps in Bangladesh, Cox's Bazar.
So what kind of areas did you focus on and why?
Well, in general, we wanted to get a better image about the demographic information of all those people living in Shamlapur and Unchaprang, and mainly people who go to these aid stations of Moas. And then we wanted to find out like what the general image of a household looks like, how people spend their lives in the camp, if they are employed, if they're not, what they like to do in their free time, if they have children, if their children go to some kind of school, formal or informal. That's basically it, yes.
And what would you say are your sort of key findings so far?
Well, some basic demographic information to begin with, like our sample consisted mostly of women, 70% is women, and then we have most of them being new Rohingya, meaning they came after August 2017 to the region. One really interesting finding is that, unsurprisingly, almost a fifth of women are widowed, which has to do with the situation before coming to the camps. Then on the household information, I would say that more than three quarters of the households are run by a male, whereas we could say that there are more houses run by female in Shamlapur compared to Unchaprang. Most households consist of 5 to 9 people, and most of them are run by people who are in their mid-20s to mid-30s.
Okay. Just to broaden that, you know, that feature a bit more about households and the dynamics behind it, how do they fund themselves? And did you get a sense, based on the information you gathered, on what they do day to day?
I mean, I can start off with this because, in fact, the Rohingya, they're not officially allowed to work. And this is something that is obviously very difficult because they have time on their hands in the camps and they would normally be trying to work. However, our findings have suggested that, of course, people are working, they are trying to earn some money. They receive donations and aid, and this is how they survive, food aid, non-food items. But ultimately, people still want to earn a living. They still want to have some kind of semblance of normality. They want money so perhaps they can have some form of savings and a safety net. These people, they came with nothing. They arrived with absolutely nothing. They left everything behind.
And our basic findings, I would say, is that the means that people pay for their needs depend on each camp. In Shamlapur, we found that most people sell non-food aid items, like everything they would have in their possessions already in order to make a living. Whereas in Unchaprang, most people rely on assistance by a family member, either a child or somebody else living abroad or with them. Then we also found that fishing plays a small part of earnings in Shamlapur, whereas in Unchaprang, no. And then in Unchaprang, people mostly rely on charity as well.
And this is what was particularly interesting about our findings, was that these are two quite diverse locations. Shamlapur is a host village. It's predominantly fishing and farming. Unchaprang is a pop-up sort of camp that has only happened since August 25th. And so there are more opportunities to live, you know, inverted commas, a normal life in Shamlapur than in Unchaprang. Unchaprang is a particularly difficult environment for the Rohingya to live in.
This could also explain how they spend their time in camps, because we found that in Shamlapur, for example, they Most people collect wood, food, water, or the basics that they need. Whereas in Uchiprang, they spend their time in the household and caring for the sick people that they have in their houses. And whereas in Shamlapur, where we could say that it's a more stable environment, they just care for their children to be safe. Yeah.
So what does this tell us about the Rohingya people and, in a wider sense, the situation on the ground?
I think, we should be reminded that these are human beings and they have the same needs and desires that you and I do. They want some kind of normality, whatever that might be. They've come from an extremely difficult situation in, mostly from northern Rakhine State. But they still want the same things that we do. They still want to be able to provide for their families. They want to be able to eat the food that they're used to, that's normal for them, not just live off beans and rice, for example, which is what they have every day. But of course, if you were eating this three times a day every day, you would want to eat something that's more similar to back home, try and get some fish, try and get some vegetables. So I think this really just gives us an indication that, they are still human beings. They want the same things that we do, and they're just trying to find some kind of sense of normality there.
And certainly in terms of the provision of formal education to children beyond the ages of 13, can you give me some explanation as to these figures, what's behind them and why?
Education has been, I think, particularly difficult to provide to children in Uchiprang and Shamlapur, particularly in Uchiprang. And what our findings have shown us is that actually most children are in some form of education, but this education varies. So there's formal education, which would be like a normal school situation that you and I might go to. And there's informal education, which is set up as sort of educational spaces that are for mostly very young children up to the age of 5 or 6. And then we have the madrasas that kind of run parallel to this. And most children are in some form of education, but not the standard that you and I are used to, and certainly not really over the age of 12, 13. In fact, much younger. Most children after the age of about 12 would be just helping their family out. They would be trying to earn some money. They would be involved in chores. Girls as well, culturally, would normally be, the parents would try and keep them inside from the age of around 12 because this is the time of puberty. So there are many factors involved in this.
Yeah, I would like to add an interesting finding that we had concerning that last thing that you said, is that most of the parents that have at least one boy and one girl do not seem to distinct between who goes to school and who not. So we have 80% of those people saying that both their daughter and their son goes to school or receive some kind of education.
Based on the sample size, you found that the vast majority of the Rohingya feel safe in Bangladesh. It may seem completely obvious, but what should we conclude from this figure? And certainly in connections with repatriation efforts.
I'd say actually it's not all that obvious. When you reflect on how these people are living in, crowded, very crowded, unhygienic environments in a host country. On the ground, recent reports from other international organisations have indicated that there are some quite serious safety concerns, particularly for women and children. Many wash facilities are not separated for women and men, putting women at risk of things like sexual harassment. They don't feel comfortable. Children are taking on adult jobs, collecting firewood, because maybe they're not in school, and they're vulnerable to being abducted and trafficked. So these are certainly not easy environments to live in at all. However, what our results indicate is a wider understanding or perhaps emotional feeling of safety. The camp environments are extremely tough, yes, but not compared to the constant threat that the Rohingya were under in Myanmar, where they constantly feared for their lives and were made to feel unwelcome in their own homeland. So respondents mentioned that for the first time in their lives, they were actually able to sleep at night. So regardless of the maybe some of the petty crime that's going on and the difficulties with, a very large population all living on top of each other in extremely uncomfortable conditions, which is a breeding ground for certain levels of crime, overall, people certainly felt safer in the wider sense compared to what they were facing back home.
And an interesting answer that we received also is when we asked people at the end of each interview to add something, if they would like to add something, it was only women, those who said that they're not thinking of going back anymore. So only a small number of women, but they chose to share that with us, which is something important, I think.
Particularly because many of the women we spoke to, in Shamlapur especially, were widows and had obviously been subjected to terrible things and witnessed awful things. Many had witnessed their own husbands and families being killed. And for them, the idea of going back is intolerable.
Do you have any future plans as far as the Rohingya surveys go? What, do you have an idea of where your next sort of research and analysis will take you?
Well, I mean, the whole point of the snapshot survey is of course, to get some kind of indication of what's going on in the day-to-day lives of those in the camps. But it has a wider purpose, which is, you know, depending on the findings, it may give us some kind of indication of what needs to be looked into further. So based on this survey, we may be looking into certain issues that we think are important and need further investigation. But besides that, we, of course, at this particular point in time, with what's going on with talk of repatriation, we would like to understand this in a little bit more detail. So it would make sense to us to create some kind of trilogy with the surveys to have a more qualitative look into what people are really feeling about repatriation at the moment.
This interview just scratches the surface of Exchange's findings. And with the cyclone and monsoon season coming, their research builds a broad picture for the work of MOAS and fellow organisations operating on the ground. You can follow the link below to read the latest report and keep up to date on Exchange's research. If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment and subscribe for more podcasts from us. You can also follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can donate to help us help Rohingya refugees during the monsoon period. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.